website at kpfa.org.
And I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. I will be speaking under the auspices of Georgia Kelly and the Praxis Peace Institute on November 12th, 7:04 p.m., why not, at the Sonoma Community Center, Rising Aroused in Apocalyptic Times. Remember that apocalypse just simply means revelation, and what comes to us as revelations was just St. John of Patmos having a bad mushroom trip. So we have apocalyptic times. So onward, onward from no kings, reclaiming our democracy, every citizen's guide to transformational advocacy. We are welcoming the author of this worthy book and guide, Sam Daly Harris, that we all expand our repertoire of effective strategies, that Sam's long dedication may resonate and encourage our own dedication to participatory democracy. He is the author of Reclaiming Our Democracy, Every Citizen's Guide to Transformational Advocacy. His bio, his long work is super impressive. He founded the Anti-Poverty Lobby Results in 1980, co-founded the Microcredit Summit Campaign in 1995, and founded Civic Courage in 2012. Reclaiming Our Democracy, Every Citizen's Guide to Transformational Advocacy was named an editor's pick by Publishers Weekly, Book Life Kirkus Review, wrote, "Overall, the author's analysis of effective action is as persuasive as it is accessible, and his call to democratic participation is inspiring, a handbook for aspiring activists that readers will find to be both inspiring and practical." It's true, I feel better. His website is reclaimingourdemocracy.com, and in the show notes I've included the sign-up sheet, but you can also find that on the website reclaimingourdemocracy.com. So welcome, Sam Daly Harris, who runs on the fuel of playfulness and curiosity, agent of mycelial connectivity. Welcome.
It's wonderful to be with you.
It's wonderful, even our backstage conversation. You are already among one of my favorite multiple Scorpios in the world because you are, as Wendell Berry says, be jaunty even though fully informed. And you are fully informed, engaged, and jaunty. Very uplifting. Arkahooting, somehow you heard the interview with John Fugelsang, author of Separation of Church and Hate, A Sane Person's Guide to Taking Back the Bible from Fundamentalist Fascists and Flock-Fleecing Frauds. And that intrigued you. That got us into conversation, right?
Yeah. I was just taken by his message and your interview with him and really how it aligned with my own work with transformational advocacy. And just make a brief distinction. Everybody knows transactional advocacy, sign the petition, transaction complete. But with transformational advocacy, you're trained, encouraged, and succeed at doing things as an advocate you never thought you could do, like meet with a member of Congress and bring them on board to your issue. And when you do those things, you see yourself differently. That's the transformation. And so I was hearing that in your conversation with John Fugelsang.
That's great. And of course, I looked up the etymology of advocacy. It's from advocare, to call, to summon, to invite. And you are a great caller, summoner, inviter. And I loved the transformational, as you delineate, you know, everyone's changed. We've done many shows on beavers here on the Visionary Activist Show, transforming the relationship of ranchers to beavers from, you know, in which they viewed beavers not so much as an enemy, as an ally, because they became curious and informed, did you know that beavers waterproof a land? And the transformational part is the ranchers, Republicans largely, you know, but after gathering and learning and changing, they said, let's not sit in rows, let's sit in a circle. So I love that, as you know, everyone transformed.
Yeah.
And your book begins. Go.
I would love to tell people a bit about my journey in that I started as a musician, and I ended up as an activist, and I think it's an interesting, albeit weird, journey. But I use this method developed by Harvard professor Marshall Gans, the story of self, which basically asks, what happened in your life and what decisions did you make that got you to your commitment? And if I could tell mine briefly, I just urge listeners to think about their own. What happened in your life and what decisions did you make that got you to your own commitments? This is mine. I have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in music, and I played percussion instruments in the Miami Philharmonic Orchestra for 12 years and taught high school music. And 45 years ago, I founded the Anti-Poverty Lobby Results, and a lot of times I'm asked, music, poverty lobby, what's the connection there? And when I look back in my life, there's certain experiences that start pointing me in a different direction. The death of a friend around high school graduation in 1964, and the assassination of U.S. Senator Robert Kennedy around college graduation in 1968, got me to asking the questions of purpose. Why am I here? What am I here to do? What's my purpose? 9 years later, it's now 1977, I'm invited to a presentation on ending world hunger, and I go to this event thinking, well, hunger is inevitable. What do I know? I'm a musician. I mean, I'm thinking it's inevitable because there must be no solutions. Again, what do I know? Because if there were solutions, somebody would have done something by now. But I go to this event, and it's obvious right away. There's no mystery to growing food, clean water, basic health, literacy. I'm not hopeless about the perceived lack of solutions. I'm hopeless about human nature. People will just never get around to doing the things that can be done. But there's one human nature I have some control over, my own, and my questions, why am I here? What am I here to do? So I get involved in a big way. This is the end of the story. In 1978 and 1979, I spoke to 7,000 high school students, classroom by classroom, on ending world hunger. And before I went into the first classroom, I read statements from Jimmy Carter's Commission on World Hunger and others calling for the political will to end hunger. So I asked 7,000 high school students, what's the name of your member of Congress? I don't want to know if you wrote them. I don't want to know if you met, just the name. Out of 7,000 asked, 200, fewer than 3%, could answer correctly. 6,008, over 97%, could not tell me the name of their member of Congress. And this gap between the calls for the political will to end hunger on the one hand, and the lack of basic information on who represented us in Washington on the other, was really my entry point from musician to activist. I always say, and I'll stop with this, that I feel, because this was decades ago, I feel I had an early front row seat on the American slumber party. Now, these high school kids I was talking to are in their 60s now, and so I just had this early view, the extent to which too many of us aren't paying attention.
Right. And what we want to honor and compost, and with your help, you know, transform, you know, is Like, oh, it's all corrupt and why? But I did read that, and I was like, let me double triple check that I do know my congressperson. Oh, I'm so lucky. It's Congressman mm-hmm. Jamie Raskin. I am very lucky in my congressman. But yeah, and mm-hmm. and so there is something that we're speaking to the citizens, the in all of us listening now, going experiment, try things, and yeah, the advocacy of being, you know, intimate with those in political process is crucial. And then you do start off with a quote from Alex Stefan, whom I know, activist and friend of show, who said, "Cynicism is obedience." And it's like that's true. Yeah. And it was on that show that I just love, because we were talking about, you know, language, another world is possible, but possible sounded a little plaintive. And a caller, some hip guy from Oakland, whoever you are, I'm grateful forever, called up and said, "Yeah, I know what you mean. How about another world is percolating? We're on the turf debating how to get it percolating." Yeah. So here we are, yeah. Sam Daly Harris. You know, another world is percolating. You know, and we're part of that percolating. You know, there's also no future in nihilism. And now it's the advocacy, you know, all hands on deck. Who brought what to this apocalypse? But do you keep your music up? Do you tap the drum every now and then?
I do tap the dashboard for sure, but no, I don't really keep it up as I should. It's in me for sure, but and not out in the world enough. I want to tell you how I use that Alex Stefan quote constantly. Cynicism is obedience. I was interviewed on a national radio show, and question number two was this one, and I just want folks to hear it. This on this national show, the host said, "The passive nature to our politics today, you can feel beat down by it. I mean, this is my career," he said, "and I feel beat down by it. I don't participate the same way others do because I'm a political journalist, but I do have to pay attention. It's a grind. It's a grind, Sam. I mean, I know you know that. What am I feeling? What is the way out of that?" I was so blown away by how vulnerable he was on this interview. And the first thing I said, Alex Stefan was the second. The first thing I said was, Apollo astronaut Rusty Schweikert said, "We aren't passengers on spaceship Earth. We're the crew." Well, are we? And if we're crew, how does crew operate? And then I said, Alex Stefan, the futurist, climate activist, said, "In fact, these days, cynicism is obedience." And yeah, if I'm cynical, I'm obedient to the way things are. I'm not going to do anything. Why would I, if nothing I do makes a difference? Maybe later in the program, I can tell you the entire quote where that little phrase comes out of, because it's a spectacular statement by Alex Stefan.
That's great. I send a little wave to Alex. Because cynicism, the word comes from Cynus, who's the dog in Dante's Inferno that's biting its tail and only moving in circles. Right. So, no future in nihilism. But you're really addressing that, and I look forward to the unfolding of the rest of that story. But I was so charmed when we were meeting backstage just now too, in which you know, meet with your local congresspeople, and I can hear part of my audience going, anyway, we're going to address that. But I loved, you know, you say you have a group meeting with the congresspeople who oppose your dedication, and then you say you give them three questions to ask. I have them here, but you have them in your head. And the three questions are what?
Sure, of course. Yeah, sure. So if I'm coaching a group that's meeting with a member of Congress who opposes their bill, I do have them ask these questions. One, we know you don't support this bill. What would it take to change your mind? And you're listening for assignments. I'll tell you a story in a moment. What would it take to change your mind? Two, could you say more about that?
I love that.
Three, Why do you think that is? So it's basically a deep listening exercise. And I have a friend, Pennsylvania volunteer, and he was instrumental, actually central, in creating a House Climate Solutions Caucus. He started in 2013, and it took nearly 3 years to get it launched. And he was meeting, he decided he would work in South Florida, where there was sea level rise in Republicans and Democrats. And he was meeting with a member of Congress, a Republican, and he said to him, "What would it take to change your mind?" And the congressperson said, "Well, if you could get the Chambers of Commerce on board." And he did. Miami, Miami Beach, Coral Gables, South Miami. He comes back with letters from the Chambers of Commerce president, and the congressperson says, "Well, if you could get the mayors on board." So he's listening for assignments, and he does. He comes back with letters from the mayors, and you know, eventually this person flipped, I guess you could say. But it started with what would it take to change your mind, and listening for assignments.
No, I so love that, and it does make me bark with laughter, especially your playful, jaunty invitational self. I think that's so, because it really is you are embodying democracy. So, what would it take to change your mind? You know, and you said very often they go nothing, and then your second question: could you say more about that? That just makes me laugh every time. It's just, could you say more about that? Because you're not angry, right? You're curious. You know. And curiosity and playfulness, which is so important that we all cultivate, as well as embodying democracy, and I did say that, you know, some of my teammates who follow members of Congress down the hall, you know, yelling at them, going not completely effective. I'd like to hand them this, you know: what would it take to change your mind? Could you say more about that? And why do you think that is? Very simple. I'm putting it in my pocket to carry with me. It's really, really charming. And then I brought up seeing E.L. Wilson speak at the National Cathedral, where your wife was just teaching. And E.L. Wilson, great Harvard scientist, and he'd begun to collaborate with evangelical, you know, conservative Christians. And people were like, "Why?" And he said, "Well, they're really organized." And he said to the head of many of the evangelical conferences, "You know, we can disagree about many things. I'm a scientist and all, you know, but that's a luxury for the future. Right now, we have a common goal of stewarding the earth back to health." And he said they were very organized. Once they got on board, they were like, you know, recycling like nobody's business, and it all, you know, renewable fuels and everything. And he said to all of us, he said, "Everything's got something to offer. And if we're going to pull off any large, important thing, it, you know, and stewarding the earth and restoring the earth, it's going to take a quality of religious fervor that we can borrow from them to wed to our science." Yeah.
Yeah.
I just like, absolutely. I like that so much.
Yeah. I want to tell a transformational advocacy story. And in the vein of what you're just talking about, it's a story, a woman named Ellie Spark. She was a volunteer with Citizens Climate Lobby when she told me this story. Now she's on staff. And she said, "Before I joined Citizens Climate Lobby, I was suffering from climate trauma. I would read Bill McKibben's book, Earth, and I would weep at home and I would weep at work." And then she joined CCL, and 18 months later, she's co-leading a workshop on building relationships with members of Congress and editorial writers. And she does this whole long, glorious conversation about what she learned. But I want to tell you about the thing she said at the end. I'm going to read it from the book. She said, "During our conference in D.C., I met with 20 congressional offices over 4 days. I met with many folks whose view of the world was very different than mine. Going into their offices was hard. I had to let go of a lot of emotional baggage. I could no longer judge them or hold hostility in my heart toward them. I had to let go of my fear of climate change and my fear that they wouldn't listen to me. I had to center myself in love. Releasing fear and centering in love, this is sacred and profound work. End of quote. So she started at climate trauma and ended up at sacred and profound. And that's the transformation. And it's not easy, but it's available. A, if we find an organization that'll empower us, and B, if we open ourselves up to it.
No, that's powerfully great. And again, you know, experiment, change. You know, I say to myself and others, are things going so well we can't afford to experiment? You know, changing of mind. I mean, we are at such a dangerous but opportune time where there's, you know, it's very tippy. And so these conversations, you know, again, the word is wonderful, con is with and verse is turning. We're on this giant conversation all turning together. And what you said, to approach everyone with respect, again, a wonderful word. It means to look again, inspect, look, keep looking, you know, Aretha, respect, keep looking until you find there, and there, then the conversation can begin.
Right.
Yeah, and the beautiful story you just told about Maxine Thomas, you know, and Bill McKibben. Well, Bill McKibben's done that too. I mean, when I first read him decades ago, he was like, it's a terrible, no hope. But now he's fully informed and very dynamically plucky, like, let's go, and super dedicated. So that's a wonderful
thing.
Brilliant. He's great. And you know, just even early in your chapter 5, this is exactly what we need to be doing: engaging the disengaged. Yes. I want to keep turning over that compost. What?
Yeah, that chapter 5 is really about, again, a volunteer. He's now on staff, but he would do climate speaking tours in Wyoming, of all places. And so it's really a great example of the courage. I want to remind, when we were talking backstage, it turned out that you and I were at the No Kings March in D.C. I mean, of course, we didn't see each other with 200,000. And I always say to folks, protests are really important. They're critically important. But we also need people going inside and building relationships with members of Congress and their staff. And here's an example of why. One of the groups I'm coaching, it's called the United Church of Christ Climate Hope Affiliates. What they're working on is this: the Environmental Protection Agency. President Trump, in his fiscal year 2026 budget, the shutdown is now in FY 2026. President Trump calls for a 55% cut to the Environmental Protection Agency. The House Appropriations Committee, not the Democrats, the House Appropriations, calls for a 23% cut. The Senate Appropriations calls for a 5% cut. Well, there shouldn't be a cut, but there's a big difference between 55% and 5%. And so that's what they're working on. It's a very new organization. They just started their 9th chapter in Redding, California, a week ago Saturday. But, you know, they have a goal of getting 50 letters to the editor published by the end of the year, this brand new organization, really, in terms of these chapters. And they're working. I mean, you can poo-poo this, but, you know, they're working to get the more modest 5% cut to the Environmental Protection Agency. And too few people know about that this is something you could even be advocating for, that this is something you could be working on.
Yes. Right. No, and that quality of dedication that you found early in your life, and that really all of us, you know, what is our primary dedication? What did we come here to do? How are we dedicated to collective well-being? What form will that take? You know, and there's so many great, good rousing. So I'm still on the beginning of chapter 5, but Yeah, truly successful advocacy right groups need to be brave, pioneering, and knowledgeable, not just on the issues that they care about, but also in the arena of growing their numbers. Mobilizing the political will to solve problems at this scale we face requires a continuous process of engaging the disengaged. Yeah, no, that's really crucial. And just again to the people who go, and you go, no, here we go. Did you know about this? So you're advocating, you're inviting, and yes, there's somewhere I've got sticky notes all over, but you say. Lisa Corrigan, scholar of social movements, says, large, fun marches full of art and music expand connections and make people more willing to take risks against state power. Something communities, right? Maybe that's somebody else. But then you go, right, and here's where we are in the moment, which is yes, and then how to put up our sails to catch this wind, how to tease this into the next step, the action, which is what you're ardent about. I tracked down your birthday by finding your YouTube birthday celebration, which is great and very wonderful, and was particularly moved by Muhammad Yunus, microcredit union, and his homage to you. He won the Nobel Prize. He said that, you know, you are even using your birthday as an opportunity for goodness. You know, you have touched so many people. Mm-hmm. He says he was struggling until you came along to create the desirable, you know, dedication to create the desirable world. And I love what he said, you know, give everybody space, redesign human society. You know, there he was in Bangladesh. And then he says, but nobody was listening to us in Bangladesh. And then you, Sam, arrived and invited us to the USA and said to him, just tell what you do. And then it was a big story in the Christian Science Monitor. And then CBS 60 Minutes and Maury Schaefer, you know, came to Bangladesh with a crew for 2 months, out of which they got a 14-minute video. But huge numbers of people saw it, you know, and he goes, and then he gets the Nobel Prize, and together, you know, wonderful journey, and he pays homage to you, the millions of lives you have touched, known and unknown, and that's just a great story within a story, right? It's like you tell the story, you connect with someone like yourself, Sam, you know, who then connects to tell the story, who then tells the story, you know, and yes. For everybody, you know, it then becomes the story itself travels, going, oh, well, we could do that too. So that's just a wonderful, a wonderful part of the many, many things that you've done. Yes.
Some of the heroes in that story, it was 1987 when Results, the anti-poverty lobby, lobbied on microcredit, small loans to very poor women. And the volunteers generated 100 newspaper editorials, not letters or op-eds, where they met with the editorial writers and encouraged them to write. And they did 100 editorials in 1987. So this is... these are volunteers who are getting nervous, picking up the phone, making that call, and then having that breakthrough, that personal transformation in the service of getting Muhammad Yunus, Grameen Bank, and the power of microloans, and those who work with that known in the U.S. and beyond.
Yeah, stories. Well, to tell the story is to bring it alive. And I even just go back to your music. My long-term accomplice, Amichaela Gaston, who may or may not be with me in Sonoma, where it's a fluctuating field, but we say music and metaphor are the incarnational garb whereby power enters the world. You know, it's like, so your music and your advocacy makes sense, and also your skillful use of the word weird. To driar weird is a wonderful Celtic phrase meaning to play our role in destiny. So we're going to take a short musical break. It's the music I've been playing for the last couple of weeks because it's so wonderful, Liberties of Our Country. It's rousing. You can dance to it. You can tap along to it as well. And we will return after the break with our Skookum guest. Skookum, a wonderful word from the Pacific Northwest. It means connected to the spirits and completely competent for the work at hand. Our Skookum guest, Sam Daly Harris, again, the author of Reclaiming Our Democracy, Every Citizen's Guide to Transformational Advocacy. And his website is reclaimingourdemocracy.com. And we'll be right back after this rousing musical break. Everybody up and dancing. Here you go.
In the streets of the city, the soldiers march through. The rich drink their whiskey, the poor pay the due. But a voice in the darkness, it rises, it grows. It's the sound of the people, the whole country knows. No king but the people, no crown on that head. No throne for the tyrants, no tears will we shed. We'll stand by each other, whatever may come. No king but the people. In cages they lie, the sick and the weary, left broken to die. But their names are our thunder, their memory our flame, and the song that we carry will carry their name. No king but the people, no crown on that head, no throne for the tyrant, no tears will we shed. We'll stand by each other, whatever may come. No king but the people. The people are one.
Woof, woof, everybody up and roused, especially with the encouragement and guidance and mentoring of our guest, Sam Daly Harris. We are resuming. Here we are with guest Sam Daly Harris. He's the author of Reclaiming Our Democracy, Every Citizen's Guide to Transformational Advocacy. Very practical, useful. We're going to dive more into it. And his website is reclaimingourdemocracy.com, where you can find a sign-up sheet to be connected to you know, organizations and with which you're kin, because you are Scorpio, Uranus and Gemini. You are really doing profundity translated into accessible conversational availability. You know, with your curiosity and playfulness. Yeah, because don't you find that your irresistible playfulness and curiosity is opens doors all the time?
Well, we're going to find out. I hope so. Let me tell, if I could tell people, when I'm talking to a group, actually, last week I did my 120th in-person or Zoom talk, not counting interviews like this, in the last 22 months. And I'm telling them what to look for as to whether an organization is working to deliver transformational advocacy, really, whether they're working to feed you power. I simplified it to three things. One, recruitment and community building. They bring new people in, not to build an e-blast list, but to form them into local chapters so you're not working alone. And the community building would include a monthly whole of organization webinar with guest speakers, Q&A, inspiration. So recruitment and community building. Number two, training. How do you get the meeting with the elected? How do you plan for the meeting? What do you ask for in the meeting? How do you write a letter to the editor? Two, training. The third thing is breakthroughs. The organization encourages you to move out of your comfort zone, because that's when transformation happens, And in the book, there's this drawing of a small circle labeled your comfort zone.
I'm on it.
And next to it is a much larger circle. Yes, labeled where the magic happens. And you're looking for an organization that will encourage you out of your comfort zone over to where the magic happens. And there aren't enough organizations that do that. And if folks go to reclaimingourdemocracy.com and click on learn more, there's where the sign up sheet is. And I can help, if they're interested, connect them to a group that's working to deliver transformational advocacy.
That's adorable. Truly, we are in synchronous accord, because I am, as you spoke, right open to that page 267, your comfort zone, little circle, where the magic happens, larger circle. There we go. All right there. There we go. So that's super charming, because it's the whole part four of your book, A Handbook for Applying Transformational Advocacy to a Cause You Care About, 18 Commitments That Bring It to Life. So you can go anywhere you want, but these are really useful ones. But yeah, stepping out of comfort zone, like, oh, I never do that, or I don't want to talk to those people, or yeah, all of that, and you say, well, wherever you want to, overcome the fear of making big asks of volunteers. But that's really useful. I mean, I've been part of a, indivisible local community thing, but it's sort of dissolved, right? But now I think for everybody right now, it's like, all right, this is, as they say in the South, we ain't play acting now, children. It's like everything, every way we can to constellate and participate in community, everywhere is crucial. And so the 18 commitments that bring it to life. And before we dive into all those, and you can go wherever you want, but so, a lot of your early work on, ending hunger and ending child poverty and, vaccines for children, all these good things have been backsliding, right? But you remain indefatigable? Is that?
Yeah.
You do. Okay.
Yes. Yes. So results, the anti-poverty lobby started lobbying on child survival, as it was called back then, in 1984. And at the time, UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, was reporting 40,000 child deaths a day from preventable things, things like measles, coupled with malnutrition. As I have to tell you, I was doing this an NPR podcast, and the producer, I was in DC, and the producers were in LA. We finished the interview, and they said, we think you made a mistake. You said 40,000 a day in 1984 child death. And you meant a year, right? I said, no. In the early 80s, it was 40,000 a day. And we've lobbied every year for 41 years, and the global child death rate has fallen by 66% to 13,125 a day, a 66, still scandalously high. But then enter Elon Musk, Donald Trump, Marco Rubio, and the global child death rate is poised to go back up for the first time in 41 years that I've been working on this. So that's the reality. But the glimmer of hope is the House Appropriations Committee. Let me say it this way. One of the biggest propellers of the decline in child deaths is the maternal and child health account globally in our aid budget. And last fiscal year, it was at $915 million. And for 2026, President Trump called for a greater than 90% cut to $85 million from $915. But the House Appropriations Committee rejected Trump's cut and appropriated $915 million. Now the Senate still has to do its work, and it needs to be signed into law once the government's opened up again. And of course, then it needs to be spent. But that's an example of finding a little backbone, you know, getting a bit of a spine for a moment,
yeah.
where the House Appropriations Committee appropriated the full $915 million to the maternal and child health account. And why that happened includes that 128 members of Congress signed one letter to the top appropriators asking for robust funding for that and some other accounts. Well, how do 128 members of the House sign a letter? Well, a bunch of that is citizens getting educated, getting engaged, making those meetings, making those calls, and getting them onto that letter. So, you know, David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, said this past summer, the cuts to the U.S. aid program have brought a kind of rage I've never felt before.
Oh.
I mean, you know, even if Brooks is saying something like that, Peter Wainer, another conservative, said, if you were trying to find the most efficient way to kill millions of people, you would do what Elon Musk, Donald Trump, and Marco Rubio did. But again, there's this glimmer, I don't want to overstate it, of hope out of the House Appropriations Committee, and the Senate, once they open up, is next, basically rejecting Trump's 90% cut and making a 0%
right.
cut. And
This is crucial. I mean, this is the opportune kind of fulcrum dynamic of this moment. You know, and as part of, you know, the trickster training we've been cahooting here for a long time, you know, it's like, speak to the part of somebody you want to invite to dance with the corresponding part of yourself. There we go. Yeah, and yeah, when you say David Brooks, this brought an amount of rage, you know, and we go, right, and the power of betrayal, you know, liberated, and then, you know, here's the likes of yourself, and may we all aspire to be as dedicated as yourself, to guide that so that it's, you know, betrayal, and then here's a story, here's what you can do, here's allies across borders,
yeah.
That is, you know, so crucial to know, because even the Republicans backed out. I've forgotten the name. It starts with I, but he was going to be appointed. And he, again, more chats about, like, I really like Hitler, I'm a Nazi. Mm-hmm. And they were like, no, too far.
Yeah.
Right. So the beginning of the rebellion, and it's like, yes, team. Right. So
yeah.
It's not a time for finger wagging.
Right.
It's a time for welcome. Yes, let's do these things. You know, and that's why,
yeah.
again, you're so superbly informed, because nobody minds being asked, did you know? Right, it's a great practice,
yeah.
unless we ask it in a snarky way. But you are full. Did you know about this? And yeah,
yeah.
So
exactly.
Being
there's
full,
a quote yeah. that really sustained me. There was a quote from the mid '80s from the late Republican Senator Mark Hatfield of Oregon, and it really inspired me for decades. And I'm going to just say it right now. He said, "We stand by as children starve by the millions, because we lack the will to eliminate hunger. Yet we have found the will to develop missiles capable of flying over the polar cap and landing within a few hundred feet of their target. This is not innovation. It is a profound distortion of humanity's purpose on Earth." End of quote. This is not innovation. It is a profound distortion of humanity's purpose on Earth. It cuts right to the core of it all.
It hums, it resonates. You know, we were talking backstage. I asked
yeah.
if you knew the movie Lives of Others. Just because it's maybe 15 years old, but it's one of those things, you know, like your own dedication, that within minutes you can feel like whoever made this film, it's really dedicated.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the Stasi, but it's about how the sociopathic heart can bloom again. Not everyone, but you never know. So treat everyone as though they could be that heart that comes to life again. And it's based on a true story, but it's a person who's done terrible things, a torturer, All of that. And then he's assigned to spy on a creative kind of Venusian theatrical musical family, and it changes him. He feels kinship, and he can't go on with the cruelty. And I think now is such a powerful opportunity, you know, for that advocacy to call, to invite, you know, come on over here. Here's an inclusive story, you know, to be part of this. So, and then, yes, you go.
I had this experience, just to give the listeners an idea of the extent to which organizations can not feed us power. I was talking to the head of organizing for a very large organization. Everyone listening would know this group. And he said to me, we can't let our volunteers write letters to the editor or op-eds because they'll get it wrong and misrepresent the organization. Protecting their brand was more important than empowering the members. And I always say, you know, one of the groups I coach, Citizens Climate Lobby, the year before COVID, their volunteers had 4,300 letters to the editor, op-eds, and editorials published. One group saying they'll get it wrong. CCL was saying, well, what do we have to do to help them get it right and give that to them? And in the end, they had those 4,300 pieces published. And that's why it's so important to find an organization that's not going to look at you and say, you're going to get it wrong. You're going to misrepresent. We're not going to let you do this, this, and this. But instead, and it links to, you know, you were asking about these commitments, and the one that you mentioned, the fear of making big asks of volunteers is the one I identify as the main reason groups shy away from transformational advocacy, shy away from doing something that would feed power to their volunteers. And so it's one of the important ones.
Yeah. No, that's right. And I just opened to the page, Mark Reynolds serving as Citizens Climate Lobby's executive director. And he says, you know, I also made a conscious decision early on that if we didn't bring joy and celebration to what we were doing, we would never have success.
Yeah.
It's not that I don't take climate change seriously, but we need a different way to deal with the issue. Yeah, it's my buddy David Grimes, great poet, advocate for the ocean, says at a particularly gloomy moment, he said, now, if we're not having fun, we're just not serious enough. And it's like, oh, I needed that. There we go, peel ourselves up off the floor. Yeah. Which does not negate grief at all. And, you know, grief is love, you know, grievance is really hatred, but grief and joy, they do dance well together. And what you write is Reynolds knew that cynicism and despair were too great to address with good calls, good actions, and good coaching. Each element had to be great. And he knew that you can't ask more from volunteers every day by being a scold, right? Finger wagging. What you're delineating, you know, and that's, you know, what we all want to do in micro and macro, which is what are qualities of leadership, since we've outsourced leadership to sociopathic dingbats who care nothing about collective well-being. What is, you know, the questions, the quest begins with questions. What is all of our definition of good leadership? You know, and that's, it is throughout your book, but what is your current working definition of good leadership? What are the qualities that you most admire?
Well, I want to make the distinction between the leaders in an organization and is the president or CEO or executive director a good leader, and building leadership in the volunteers themselves, that the actions that they're taking are actions of leaders. And I was talking last month with a volunteer, and he was telling me, and this is part of the joy, you have to tell the success stories to keep the potential for joy in the conversation. He was saying to me last month that September 1st was their annual hike with their Republican U.S. senator, and he's a new senator, it was their representative, John Curtis of Utah, took Mitt Romney's seat, and there were 25 volunteers who were on a 3.5-hour hike with their Republican senator. And I said to him, well, how did this start? He said, well, when he was first elected to the House in 2017, he announced a town hall meeting hike. It would be an 8-hour town hall meeting hike. 8 people showed up, and 6 of them were from Citizens Climate Lobby, and he eventually promised them their own hike because so many were showing up. And on the first hike in 2017, a volunteer said, what are you going to do about carbon? And the then new congressman thought, well, you know, I was just the mayor of Provo, Utah. I never thought about carbon. And so it started this process for this member of Congress. But the point is, you know, who listening to this interview thinks much about 25 volunteers hiking for 3.5 hours with their Republican senator last month? We need more of that. And we need breakthroughs all across the land.
No, that's great. Yes, no, we see it. We're seeing it. You're painting these powerful molecular images with words. That's really great, Sam. Again, great ally, now ancestor Tusun Alaf, Bob Goff, said that who was working on renewable energy on Native American reservations and doing great work. But when he went to talk to conservative groups and evangelicals, he would adopt his metaphors. He was like, we don't want the fuels from hell, coal and oil. We want the fuels from heaven, sun and wind. And they're like, oh, that, you're right.
That's great.
It's very good. It's really good. Yeah. And if somebody said, you know, climate change is a hoax, he wouldn't go grr. He would go, notice any strange weather lately? Oh, yeah. Right? Again, adoptable, spiraling, changing, interested, playful, and curious. Right? That's, brilliant. Again, part of the dynamic. Yes. So effective. Yeah. And making alliances. And people would be grumpy at him for, like, why are you cooperating with the Clinton Initiative? And it's like, they're giving Native American, you know, renewable fuels, you know, these huge grants, you know, but how could you possibly deal with the Clintons? You know, it's like, well, fairy tales are full of this. You know, you're with anybody who plays, right? You're not averse to, well, you gave President Clinton your a copy of your book when it first came out, right? You don't turn up your nose at any possible ally or part of them. Yeah. You know, it's like, Sally, I've forgotten her name, you know, but who advocates for the bonobos, you know, in the Congo, and they were like, how could you deal with Laurent Kabila, this, you know, tyrant? And she goes, he's a tyrant, and he's also saving land. You know, we work with these things. Is that, right. I mean, you're that's very much your attitude, which is work with what's possible, invite to the good, don't turn up nose.
Unless you don't want to get anything done. But if you want to get something done, you have to, you know, work with whoever work with you. I'm going to give one other example of, in this glimmer of hope category, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, and its partners have saved 70 million lives since 2002. Where do you read in the news 70 million lives saved? And President Trump for 2026 called for a greater than 50% cut to the Global Fund from $1.65 billion, which was this past fiscal year, down to $500 million, greater than 50%. The House Appropriations Committee cut it to $1.5 billion, not to $500 million like Trump did. It's another, you know, glimmer of hope, and it's because two Republicans and 3 Democrats got a grand total of 160 members of the House to sign a letter to the top appropriators asking for robust funding for the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. Well, I you know, they saved with their partners 70 million lives. You're going to stop working with someone because they're something, I don't know what. It's just you want to make progress, go for it.
Yeah, no, that right, and the what you call the glimmer of hope, or the Republicans going, no, that guy's too Nazi. We were okay with the other Nazis, but that guy's too Nazi. It's a trickle, it's a stream, it's a river, right? That's what we want to kind of see, you know. And then you talk about crafty, focused, inspiring agenda. That's useful. I mean, I can just go through your headlines here, and embrace an expansive view of who people are, right? You know, and this is in fairy tales and myths. It's like you speak to the part of somebody you want to encourage, to feed their heart.
To merge. Yeah. You talked about the inspiring vision. I promised you the fuller quote from Alex Steffen.
Yes, yes.
I could share it with you now. This is the full quote. Optimism is a political act. Those who benefit from the status quo are perfectly happy with the large population of people who believe nothing will get any better. In fact, these days, cynicism is obedience. What's really radical is being willing to look right at the magnitude and difficulty of the problems we face and still insist we can solve those problems. And so, you know, thank you, Alex Steffen. Maybe you'll introduce me someday, but it's just exquisite.
Said. Well, this is also part of your website and your sign-up sheet, and you're here now, and how you connected so enthusiastically with me. You go, I heard your interview with John Fugelsang, and let's do this thing, and you know, and I'm in D.C. I can drive the book over to you. I'm like, this is adorable. And here you are, you know, important but not self-important. It's like this is an important person, but not self-important at all. You know, and again, to people who are like, oh no, would you rather be right or effective or righteous? Right, and it's like, you know, experiment. Cross borders. You know, and invite all that, cultivate inspiration and idealism. You're right. We're in our last seconds here. Is there one last blessing you want to spiral forth for your good work?
We can do this. No Kings was powerfully important, but now we need to go inside and build relationships.
That's great. That's great. Thank you so much, Sam Daly-Harris. You are a marvel. I feel like a better person. And up for more, his website is right here, reclaimingourdemocracy.com. Thank you very much. Thank you, Kirsten Thomas. Always as great. Board up. I'm Caroline Casey. We'll reconvene next week. Thank you again, Sam. Woof. Oh, yeah, yeah.